Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about some things with HTTP. So we talked about HTTP proxies, which are kind of probably an incredibly important part of why HTTP is so successful, is that it's relatively easy to have kind of something that interposes between, you know, a client and a server. And this is very common these days, most commonly in the reverse proxy setup, where we have a server that kind of acts as a front end for multiple other servers, meaning that we can add things like caching that's done sort of in addition to the client's caching. We saw the example of like Wikipedia set up where, you know, it's really valuable for them to cache things. They have lots of things that are very good to cache, like images, and most people aren't editing the pages. So you can just cache all that stuff and save yourself a lot of load on the servers that way. And generally, you can also use this to like kind of have different parts of your website sort of actually run on different machines in a way where, well, each of those components, you know, is written like a standalone web server. And we don't need any special protocols to make that work. And we also talked about kind of the other big use of HTTP, which is that we, you know, it is designed for sort of accessing files, and we typically see this in kind of the website context, but it's very often used as an interface to something else. And we've had the example of Canvas. So like Canvas, like it has all these things it keeps track of for our courses that I mostly don't use, but other people use a lot. And so like it's kind of this big database with lots of features, and you know, when you like, and you can, you know, it's not really files because like it's database entries, and we have like announcements. When you make an announcement, it doesn't just write a file somewhere or, you know, add an entry to a database. It also like sends emails and things like that. So we can have our API for that via over HTTP, and the most common mapping people end up using is this representational state transfer idea, where the representational state is that, well, we're going to have things that kind of look like files in HTTP land, often like will represent some database entry as JSON, and the way you edit that is by using the HTTP request to write a file or post a file, typically put for overwriting something and post for creating a new thing. And you pass in that JSON format, but what actually happens underneath is that gets translated into an appropriate database update or whatever update to the backend, including all the steps of like, oh, if you made a new announcement, we need to send that announcement out, and so on. And this is, it's very common. You'll see tons of services have kind of designed things around using these REST APIs, even in cases where maybe the sort of state transfer idea is like made less clear, you know, like where we're doing actions on items that like trigger a real world action, for example. You know, like buying something or something like that. Then we moved on to our next topic where we're going to continue today, which is about multi-access media. And we started out by talking about this sort of naive Aloha protocol, where the idea was we have a shared medium. In the case of Aloha, their shared medium was radio signals around Hawaii in the original implementation. But the same principles apply to like a shared wire. So we mentioned that like kind of old Ethernet, we just electrically connected all the computers in the really old Ethernet with these vampire taps where we literally like screwed in a piece of metal into this big wire from each machine. And the naive way of dealing with that is we just transmit whenever we want to, and sometimes this will work out, and other times we'll have what we call a collision, where two signals are happening at the same time, and the result is unintelligible. And we learned that kind of our maximum effective bit rate once we account for the fact that, well, when we have collisions, we don't receive anything useful, and we're probably going to retransmit when we have a collision, is that we get about 18% of the capacity we'd have if just one person was transmitting the whole time, which is pretty bad. So we're going to talk about some fixes for this, and we sort of introduced two, which I'll review in a bit, because we're going to extend to on them. So one is this carrier sense idea, that we're going to use, is that with sort of the naive approach, we just transmitted whatever we want. We didn't kind of check whether someone was transmitting before. And we learned that kind of what we're worried about is that if we chose to transmit at one time here, that one of the problems we would have is that someone was already transmitting. And it seems like, gosh, we should be able to detect that situation and avoid it. And this should get us, basically twice the efficiency. And in fact, that's what happens when we do the slotted Aloha approach, which we mentioned is fixed size slots. That's what happens when we do that. And the carrier sense idea is kind of what we use, as kind of our default for wireless, for Wi-Fi, I should say. Cellular networks, we're going to see that much later, that there's a different approach they use that's very different. So that's, what we're going to look at. And we're going to see that this idea of see if someone's transmitting, it's going to have a few problems that we're going to have that's going to make it maybe less effective than it looks right now. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So I'd like to do a brief interlude on the assignment that's due Friday, which is the web server assignment. And in fielding office hour type questions, one thing I realized is I didn't talk about what happens with sockets when you close a connection, which is relevant to this assignment. I didn't talk explicitly about it. So the other end stops sending and typically calls close or shuts down its connection. And in our assignment, since we have to implement persistent connections, you're going to accept a request and keep looking for a request until the other end gives up. Or it's okay if you implement a timeout, which would be another strategy, but fundamentally, most likely what's going to happen is you're going to be looking for a request and the other end will just close the connection. So what does that look like? So there's kind of a clean case and an unclean case here. So the clean case is you're trying to read and you call receive or receive from and you'll get an empty buffer. So that's kind of the normal close, or there's actually a operation called shut down. You can look up the arguments for it, which is a way of not closing, but saying I'm not receiving or I'm not transmitting or both explicitly. But in either case, this in the good case where things work out right, this will cause a kind of clean close, and receive or receive from will tell you, hey, there's no more done. And we'll tell you that by returning an empty buffer, not an error. But sometimes we won't have closes work that way. Like, if the application terminates abnormally or like the network connection drops out and, we better handle this, we'll get kind of an unclean close. And so we'll get some sort of exception from receive or receive from. Connection reset by a peer would be an example. There's some others you might get too. In C, this is get receive or receive from or return -1 and an error. And the empty buffer case in C is that they return 0. Where in C, they return the number of bytes read. So they return 0 bytes read. That is different than that. And I guess one thing I should mention is that if you're non-blocking, this is not what they do. They do not return 0 when it's non-blocking. 0. So this is only end of connection, even if non-blocking. So if they're non-blocking and there's no data available, they'll return an error, meaning throw an exception. They will not just return zero. So returning an empty buffer or zero in the C case tells you it's actually the end of connection, even if you set it as non-blocking. And if you set it as non-blocking and you want to handle there's no data available, you better, in Python, you probably want to try catch. The other case of an unclean close is even if they call close normally, but if they call it when you're about to send something, then the send is going to fail. And the send fails in a weird way. In Python, it's less weird because it just fails with what's a broken pipe error. That's the name of the exception. If you're doing this in raw C, you'll discover that it sends a signal to your process of sig pipe, which is often very surprising. And by sending a signal to your process, I mean if you don't handle this signal, your process just dies. Even if you have like error handling for send. You can avoid this, and most servers I know do avoid this because they have written code to handle errors from send or write. And typically they'll avoid this by either ignoring sigpipe, or you can pass in the flags argument to send that we usually don't use. You can pass this on Linux, you can pass message no signal to say, please don't send me the sigpipe and kill my whole process. I'll handle it, don't worry. I think the intuition behind why it's designed this way is often people don't really check for errors from send, and it's not useful to have your process keep going if you aren't checking for these errors correctly when the other end of the connection is closed. So questions about sort of our socket closing detection issues? Yeah?
So I was getting to an issue where like the receiver was hanging. Is that, I think that's related to like it not getting a signal back to close. So that was like waiting on timeout.
So the question, you're having the receiver hang?
Yes.
So that is, so I guess the question is like, depends on what client we're using, right? So in the assignment, we only require you to handle one connection at a time. So if something's trying to use multiple connections, you don't need to handle it. And otherwise, we generally expect that eventually that one connection will be closed. If you're using something like Perl or Netcat, it's going to be pretty obvious when the connection's closed because when it exits. If you use like a browser, well, the browser might try to do something clever and just keep the connection open for a while. And that's how it works, and you're not non-conformant if you don't handle that. You're not non-conformant if you don't accept new connections until the browser finishes. So frequently browsers will say, oh, I'll keep the connection open for 30 seconds just in case there's more things I have to fetch. You know, that's a reasonable heuristic, and it doesn't really cost anything to keep the connection open for the browser. It might cost something for the server, but the server can just close it if it wants.
Okay.
And if you wanted to mitigate that, something you can do is you can like set a timeout on your send, on your receive, and say, hey, if it takes more than 2 seconds, I'm out. I would still count that as supporting persistent connections as long as you're not like waiting a millisecond. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Or other general homework Q&A? Okay. Okay. So last time you mentioned the idea of, you know, this slots idea, that kind of our problem with, you know, the naive Aloha strategy was that normally, you know, after a transmission, we would transmit, you know, here or here or here or here or here or here. And that meant if we had two transmissions, they could easily kind of randomly interfere, and we had to have this big quiet period to ensure that didn't happen. So the first fix Aloha did to that was slotted Aloha, where they had some way of synchronizing everyone's timing. And everyone chooses the slot to transmit in. And they actually didn't use carrier sense here before transmitting. And there's a good reason for that, which is that if we're all synchronized in our timing, and our packets are fixed sized, then there's no sense in doing carrier sense, because if we're actually synchronized, then either we're going to be dead on and interfere with each other, or, you know, you're just going to be looking at what's happening in the previous slot, and they're going to finish by the time you start. So if your synchronization is correct, there's no reason to do carrier sense. Of course, doing the synchronization may be easier said than done, and there's a problem we kind of have skipped over that's kind of important, which is propagation delay, that the signal doesn't instantaneously get from A to B. I believe slotted Aloha in practice had a very low bit rate, which kind of avoids this propagation delay problem. So the slots were pretty long relative to how long it took the signals to get there. But this does not describe like modern Wi-Fi or cellular networks, where the amount of time the signal takes to get there is often enough time to send most of a message or all of a message. And I mentioned last time sort of the 802.11b strategy. So 802.11b I'll use as an example a bunch of times, not because it's like the right strategy, but because it was like the first widely deployed version of Wi-Fi. And it's much simpler than the modern versions of Wi-Fi. And they had this, you know, they had these 20 microsecond slots, and they have this 50 microsecond interframe spacing. And in 802.11b, they always do carrier sense before transmitting. And the rule is that you have to wait until that 50 microsecond period after the last data transmission happened before you can transmit again. And this ensures that there's time to get the ACK of the packet. And you might say, why aren't we like looking for the time after the ACK or something like that? The assumption is we want a quiet period in case the ACK doesn't come, or in case we don't receive the ACK. So we'll talk about a big problem we're going to run into that's going to break a lot of sort of our naive ideas about carrier sense, is that not everyone receives the same stuff. That's like a big problem in wireless. So what they do here is, you know, they transmit after you have see the channel idle for that period. And if you have a conflict, you wait that period plus an extra amount of time. And the purpose of this isn't that these slots are actually going to sort of prevent us from choosing the same slot, because our packets are in fact going to be much bigger than a slot in 802.11b. And we notice we need like 2.5 slots of quiet time. They're going to prevent us from being exactly synchronized about when we start. We're either going to be exactly synchronized or far enough apart that we can detect the carrier from the previous slots. That's kind of the idea here about having these slots. That's the advantage. So it's much less of an advantage than in slotted Aloha, where it kind of solves our problem without us doing carrier sense. Here, we're gonna need carrier sense to make this effective, but the idea of having slots is that we'll always detect if there's a transmission starting in the previous slot. We'll never have this case where we both decide to start transmitting like slightly offset. We're either gonna be dead on with each other or not, pretty much. And in particular, in 802.11b, kind of the time to transmit like, is like 27 to 1,000 microseconds at the max bit rate. So that's a whole lot of slots. So talking talking about slot times. So let's say here. So let's say I have a hypothetical protocol like 802.11b. Now let's say my packets take 1 to 10 microseconds to transmit. And when I'm detecting whether someone's transmitting, I need a minimum of a tenth of a microsecond to do that. Otherwise, I haven't looked at for a signal for long enough. How long of a slot should I use to sort of space out my additional transmissions? Any ideas? So there's multiple kind of things we'll have to deal with that we haven't talked about yet that will make this question more complicated. And or maybe we'll say it doesn't really matter. Yeah?
Maybe 0.25.
Why 0.? So you say 0.25? How do you get that?
Just multiply the minimum time for that carrier by 25 times.
OK, so you're saying we want to base it on this time to detect the carrier. And what's the intuition? Why do we want to use the time to detect a carrier?
Just to ensure that it never happens in the case where two connections start within 0.1 microsecond from each other.
Okay. So your intuition, and I think the idea is that one way we can phrase it is that if we choose two different k's, we want it to be the case that we actually don't interfere. Otherwise, what's the point of choosing different k's, right? The point of having this kind of random choice is that if we choose different random things, we don't contend anymore. And by having it from like 0 to 32, this means that, you know, we have a 1 in 32 chance if there's two people, and, you know, and a slightly higher chance if there's 3 or 4 or 5 transmitters of interfering the second time. So in order to make this work, we need to make sure our, you know, k equals 1 and k equals 2 are spaced far enough apart that will actually detect the carrier. Yeah. So I think the idea of something based on the time to detect the carrier is probably the right idea, since we're doing carrier sense. And note that this is different than our fixed size frame case where, well, we know that if someone transmits in the previous slot, we know when our next transmission time could be. In the case of 802.11b, since we're doing carrier sense, what we'll do instead in that style of protocol is we'll detect the next transmission, and then we'll say, oh, I've chosen to go 5 units after the last transmission. That's my last transmission. So we'll just keep waiting and restart our timer, you know, from 0 after that transmission. Other ideas for this? Okay, so we have an idea here. So something else to note here is that we have these sort of quite long transmissions here. And if we are unlucky and choose the same k, with what I've shown you so far, we're going to waste like a millisecond sending stuff that we're sending stuff, and that's pretty bad. Because that means we're gonna have this packet that we started sending that's not useful, right? If we had any interference, it's not useful. And with the protocol I've shown you so far, we wait for an ACK at the end. That's how we tell if it got there. We don't stop early. So one mitigation for this is we can send things in smaller chunks. But you might say, well, gosh, you know, we have this shared channel. Can't we figure out earlier that interference happened? And better than the strategy of we're going to not transmit, you know, the whole 1,000-byte packet at a time. We're going to transmit it in these smaller chunks. Like, that's one strategy, but obviously that's inefficient because we have to wait between each chunk. And so one idea you might have is, well, let's listen to the channel while we're transmitting and detect when there's a collision, because, well, everyone can receive from the channel, so we'll be able to tell that. And unfortunately, this idea doesn't work on wireless. We'll talk about why it doesn't work on wireless later, but it does work in some other contexts. Notably, it works on wires. And this is, in fact, the strategy Ethernet uses. So in Ethernet, we can send something that takes a while, would take a while, and stop it early when we detect a collision, rather than having this case where we end up wasting the whole frame transmission time and then you just get this garbage data that we can't use. But there's a kind of a fundamental limitation with this technique, which actually isn't the problem we have with wireless, but is something that makes this kind of limited in where we can apply it. And that's that, well, we have propagation delay. So for Ethernet, we're not going to instantaneously detect the collision. If we have two nodes that are far apart on a cable, well, the signal's going to propagate down the cable, and we'll have to receive back the combination of our transmitted signal and the one we're receiving from the other end of the cable with some delay. And this means that there's going to be some amount of time before we notice that happened. And what's worse is that if things are too spread out, and we're, say, transmitting to someone over here, they might have a collision from their perspective, and we might not know. Because if things are spread out far enough. And the Ethernet solution to this problem is that we're not going to allow this to happen by limiting the length of the cable. We're going to say you can't make the cable too long, or else it won't, too long for collision detection to work. So let's talk about that. So with 100 megabit Ethernet, which is basically the last version of Ethernet that supported multiple access hubs, let's say, what is our maximum cable length based on this idea? That we want the cable to be short enough that we can reliably detect collisions. So how should I compute this? Or do I need more information? Anyone? What's the good thing, good starting point here? And I guess we can do some sort of approximate number. So 2/3 the speed of light propagation means we have about 200 meters per nanosecond. And 100 megabits is sort of 1 bit per 10 nanoseconds. And the kind of scenario we're worried about is that we have our shared cable, we're at the opposite ends of it, someone's in the middle, or maybe not really in the middle, but right, like we have some electrical connection here like that. And the issue is that they'll get a collision and we won't know, and therefore won't retransmit what we should. That we have our transmitters here. Yeah, our two transmitters won't retransmit even though there's a collision and they should. So someone wanted to tell me what's something we should try to figure out. Yeah. So I'm referring to the cable length, the cable length limit is going to be kind of the overall length between any two nodes that the maximum will allow.
So I guess we should divide the size of the internet packet by the speed of transmission.
Okay, so we should figure out how long does it take to transmit a packet. That seems like transmit a minimum size packet. So minimum frame time is going to be 320 nanoseconds. And then we want to think about kind of what's the worst case. And I think the worst case here is that if I'm transmitting here to here, and we're getting a collision here, that I'm going to see the corresponding packet there with a delay that is kind of this much, right? Whereas they're exactly synchronized over here. So I need that kind of difference to be enough that my packets will overlap for me, that will have some sort of overlap. Yeah. Oh, yes, it's 1,000, 320 times 8, yes, which is going to be like about 1.5 microseconds. So I guess the question is, like, can we detect this collision here? And I guess the issue is that we're going to have our two transmissions, like, if they overlap like this, are we going to notice that there's something there? And I guess, I missed an important thing, is that we're going to have some sort of preamble of no data. Which is precisely to detect the collision. So a common thing we'll do in these collision detection scenarios is we'll have some sort of fixed data that's designed to make the collision very apparent and is also not where we're actually transmitting data. And sort of a rough approximation is that we basically want this kind of minimum frame to always interfere with our transmission for us at some point if we're going to be overlapping. I think there's an issue. I didn't think through this example fully. But it's kind of the big problem is that if we can not receive the packet from the other end at all, so it doesn't overlap with us at all, even though it's going to overlap for most other people on the network, is like the biggest issue we can have. So, and 1.5 microseconds. Did I do? Second. Yeah. But I guess so that's the minimum time, but the actual But I guess what Ethernet is usually limited to is like actually much less than 1,000 meters, because we have this observation that even if we have some overlap here, right, we need actually to have things very tight for us to guarantee that, you know, the delay from here to here is not going to kind of dominate that. So kind of typically Ethernet networks do support very small, well, not very small, but like you can't do multi-kilometer cable lengths with 100 megabit Ethernet. You have to do much less than a kilometer. And I think kind of the observation is that we like try to think about, oh, but you know, we can, you know, we have so much, we're gonna have some overlap, you know, if these 232 byte things are there, but we can have them kind of like spread out, right? Where I guess we'll have, I'll call this A, B, and C, where like C might see the two packets barely overlapping. We want that to be reliably detected if that's a problem. So in order for that to happen, we need to have the difference between the propagation delay from A to B and A, you know, that difference from zero, the total propagation delay, to be like relatively small compared to how long it takes us to send even like a few symbols for us to reliably detect collisions. We can less reliably detect collisions over a longer distance, but it's not so good. Yeah. I talked about, that's related to like, you know, we want to send only a few, we want to rely on having, I guess, I did not give the full right information in this problem. This is the problem with me making things up at the last minute, is that I didn't think about how this actually works carefully enough. I plan to do it in lecture. So the main issue is that it's not enough to detect any overlap, because we want to detect any overlap at C, right? So actually what we're looking for is we want to figure out how much stuff do we have at the beginning of the packet. So if we have like I think we have like a 16-bit preamble. So if a 16-bit preamble, then we have kind of 16, like 160 nanoseconds to detect. 160, yeah, overlap. If we want to detect overlap of just one bit, if we want to detect, you know, sort of one bit overlap, we would need a 200 meter. We'd have a max 200 meter cable length. And as far as like what the max effective cable length is, it's kind of that things are gonna, it's not that you can't run more than like 200 meters, it's that you're going to start to get problems the higher you go, the more likely it is that you're going to have a scenario where things overlap. Under 200, under like that one bit time, like we're guaranteed that there's no chance we'll not detect a collision. So that, I think that's the kind of reasoning here. And if you see guides for 100 megabit Ethernet, they'll typically tell you you can't run they'll advise staying like below a couple hundred meters of cable length. Even though, yeah, you can get away with running it higher, because usually we'll still detect a collision. But the sort of almost guarantee is like we have to actually stay like below one symbol time. But it's probably pretty good if we overlap the preamble, but is that, I think that's the like actual verification. So like the actual cable length, like if we want to like detect any overlap, is kind of one symbol time. If we want to be, we can be more generous than that, in which case we probably will have some undetected overlaps depending on kind of how, whether we have this actually like really bad configuration or not. Like this is kind of the worst case, and probably our real Ethernet networks that are very long don't look like this. But we don't have someone who's exactly in the middle receiving everything, which is like where our worst case comes from. But But yeah, that gets us around like a 200 meter cable length for detecting any one bit of overlap. And if we can tolerate like a lower probability of detecting a collision, better. So questions about that? And sorry for fumbling that. Yeah. So I wanted this exercise kind of as a, you know, so the sort of useful, you know, this tells us that like we can't have very long cables, and this is why Ethernet is not like one of the reasons why we limit Ethernet propagation, even though it's like not that you can't send a signal over long distances, it's that you can't do collision detection over long distances without, you know, some sort of delay being factored in somehow. Or without like some knowledge of that of where your receiver is relative to you as far as propagation delay. Like if you know everyone's on either end of the wire, it's a lot easier. Yeah.
No, just making sure. So if we have a cable that's length with distance less than the maximum, then it will detect collision as soon as possible.
Then it will detect a collision reliably, is what I would say. So if we have a cable that's like long enough that we're guaranteed to have overlap.
But I thought even if we have a cable length that's longer than that, you would still be able to detect a collision. It's just the bigger phase of the...
So if we have a cable length that's longer, we can still detect a collision. The issue is that we might have a scenario where there's no, where there's a collision for C here, but not for A and B. So the problem, I guess I can try to draw this out. The problem one of the problems we're worried about is that at A's point of view is A transmits here and receives B's transmission with some delay, right? And from B's point of view, B transmitted here and receives A's transmission with some delay. This is our A to B with C here. And from C's point of view, C receives both these transmissions with a delay, and they overlap. So that's the problem I'm worried about here, is that even though we can detect collisions reliably, because of propagation delay, the collision doesn't happen at the end. So if we're just looking for, are these two signals happening at the same time? Well, they aren't. So if our logic is see if these two signals are interfering, this is not, we aren't going to detect this collision, even though we can't transmit to C here, right? C is not getting anything useful.
Even if you have like a short enough cable length, can't you still make this situation happen by
Can't we still make the situation happen by condition of C? So the cable length shortness we're having is going to be is going to ensure that either the overlap is in the beginning end where we can safely deal with it, is the idea. And so to make this collision detection work, something we're going to do is we're going to have some sort of stuff at the beginning of the transmission that is just to synchronize everyone together. And if we have and enough of that needs to be non-interfered with. So if there's like one bit of overlap there, that shouldn't be a problem. So we have a slight amount of leeway. And since we're keeping things in about roughly one symbol, I think that shouldn't matter. Well, the interference that we don't detect will only be kind of at the very beginning end of that, or end of the transmission, where we have, I guess we also have some synchronization sort of at the end, typically. Or there will be a quiet period there.
But I think based on this strategy, though, it's not really dependent. Like, whether the collision is correctly detected is not dependent on the length of the cable. It's instead determined on whether there's a
the question, you're saying it's determined based on the difference between the receiving time of A and C, or C and B, right?
Yes.
I agree, yes. But that is determined by the length of, the maximum that can be is determined by the length of the cable. Does that make sense? So because how far A and C are separated, right, this is a cable length.
Yes.
And this is a cable length, right.
Even if they're offset by a little, as long as it's offset more than the beginning and end part that's checking, C won't be able to detect the collision, right?
So the example that's bad, so if A and B are transmitting, right, the problem that's bad is that C will detect the collision, but A and C won't. Because remember, the idea of collision detection is that A and C kind of give up on transmitting. And know to retransmit early. And kind of, I guess, the really bad case is that if A is transmitting a long packet, we want to make sure we don't want it to be the case that B thinks, oh, my packet was transmitted fine, I'm good. And the difference in propagation delay creates a problem for that. But yes, I have fumbled this. I will need to think about the details. It does limit the cable length because the propagation delay means that we won't observe the collision reliably unless we somehow account for that difference. But it's the difference, yeah, between what C and the two nodes receive. Does that maybe kind of clarify things?
I think there's still questions, but
Yeah, probably should move on. Sorry. Fumbling. Sure. So the main reason I wanted to bring up this propagation delay issue of like, so it's an issue for detecting collisions because it means that something that looks like a collision to some node might not look like a collision to another node. And the other issue is that, you know, this issue is going to come up in wireless for like our act timing, right? That we mentioned that we have this 50 millisecond spacing to include the time for an ACK. So if we wait longer than the propagation time for 50 microseconds, we wait longer than the 50 microsecond propagation time, which is about 15 kilometers, then this doesn't work anymore. Then we're going to have people transmitting over our ACK. Also, we're not going to wait long enough for an ACK. So this is another way in which we kind of are. The propagation delay makes this, you know, our carrier sense idea not work so well anymore. So the carrier, you know, we just lose it. This propagation delay makes the carrier sense and the collision detection just not, like, actually tell us if the, you know, if there's a carrier at the place we actually care about, you know. Which is going to be our issue. Okay, and I mentioned that we can't do collision detection in wireless. And this is not just a propagation delay issue. Like, if we're doing long distance wireless, we can't do it because we're not going to see a collision when there actually is one if we could do that. Or because we're not at the place where the receiver is. We want to know if there's a collision at the receiver. Just listening to see if there's interference when we're transmitting, not going to tell us that unless the propagation delay is low. If we're thinking about wireless transmission, kind of the way wireless transmission works is that our signal's power kind of goes down. So this is our signal loss increases kind of exponentially with distance. So this is a log-log scale, so it's a straight line, but that means we have exponential increase. So when we double our distance, we get kind of a lot, half the power or so. And a way we can reason about what happens with interference is that there's the theorem that I'm not going to prove because I'm not an electrical engineer, but from electrical engineering has this idea that, you know, the best you can do on a, as far as the bit rate you can actually transmit is based on this idea of a signal to noise ratio, which in this formula is specified in absolute units. Typically you'll see it quoted in dB, which is a log scale, but here it's in absolute units. But basically this says that the power of our signal, how strong that is, typically measured in like watts, versus the power of the noise, which we'll say is, you know, all the other stuff. And the typical abstract model is we have some noise floor. There's some stuff always on the radio that we have to deal with, and any interfering signals. So that ratio needs to be big enough. And that determines the maximum bit rate at which we can transmit and actually have the signal be intelligible. And this is also based on the bandwidth. This is why having sort of more frequency available to you gives you sort of more stuff you can transmit. So one thing this means is that we can kind of mitigate our signal loss by transmitting at a lower bit rate. And this is in fact something like Wi-Fi does. So for example, 802.11b like has a whole bunch of different bit rates it supports. And the idea is that devices choose their bit rate based on the signal to noise ratio usually. They usually try to have some hardware to measure how strong is our signal relative to the other junk and use that to determine how far it transmits. But this idea means that when we have two signals going on, that we're going to receive only the closer signal, because with this exponential loss, if we're transmitting at similar power, it's going to be way, way stronger than the other one. And the signal-to-noise ratio for it is going to be ridiculously bad, you know, if we're trying to isolate the blue signal here instead of the purple signal. So we basically can only receive the strong signal. We cannot receive the weak signal. And this is a reason why our collision detection won't work. That in this case, you know, even if the transmissions actually overlap after accounting for the propagation delay, then we're going to have this issue that B's receiving its own transmission is going to be so much stronger than A that there's no way it's going to be able to figure out that there's actually a collision, practically speaking. And so this is why we don't do collision detection in wireless, that we can't do it even if the things are close enough that we're guaranteed that things will overlap for us if they overlap for a receiver. And obviously it really doesn't work over the original Aloha scenario where they're like separated by hundreds of kilometers. So that synchronization might not be very, yeah, we might not detect until too late depending on how long the transmissions are guaranteed to be. So we can do carrier sense, and we will. You know, and if there's no other signals, we can detect a weak signal for carrier sense. But the problem we have here is that we could be in range of who we're receiving from, and our carrier sense might not tell us about someone else who's transmitting and would interfere with us. So here's another case where we'd have a collision. And even if they start transmitting before us, we're not going to know from carrier sense that that's happening. But if we tried to transmit from B to D, that's not going to work at this time, right? We're going to cause a collision. In fact, it's more than not going to work. Not only is B's transmission not going to get there, B is going to make it so A's transmission probably doesn't get there either. And this is known as the hidden node problem. And this is going to be a big reason why that this carrier sense idea works out a lot less nice than we'd like. Is that if we have to worry about this situation, we're going to have a lot of cases where we do all our carrier sense stuff and it's wrong. We still have collisions and we don't know about it. And this is why Wi-Fi has the strategy of doing explicit acts. It's because if you don't do explicit acts, you just have no clue. Like, you're not going to have a good probability in cases like this of figuring out your packet didn't get there otherwise. Like, even though if we can all receive each other, carrier sense does a pretty good job of avoiding most collisions. Here, it's definitely not going to happen. And there's kind of an opposite problem here. So here, our problem is that sort of A and B can both transmit to D, can't receive each other. And we said, okay, this is why carrier sense won't work. But, you know, when carrier sense works, we should try to use it. But we could have some other issues with that, which is that, let's say, A is transmitting to C, B is transmitting to D. In this case, if B does carrier sense, B's going to say, A is transmitting, better not transmit right now. Even though it's actually perfectly fine for B to transmit to D, that this, there's no relevant interference here. Because D can't receive A anyways, and C can't receive B, so we can actually transmit at the same time here, and carrier sense will tell A and B that, we should be taking turns, even though it's completely unnecessary to take turns in this case. So this is known as the exposed node problem. And so in the exposed node problem, we want to detect these other transmissions, but not kind of interfere with them. So we detect these other transmissions and they don't interfere. In the hidden node problem, we don't detect them and they do interfere. These are like two big issues that kind of make our carrier sense approach just not work out very well. And if we go back to what we talked about earlier with like choosing a slot time, like we originally said, we should choose a slot time that's approximately this. And this is going to tell us, we can do that. If we have hidden nodes, this ain't so great. Is there a better solution? Well, that's hard to say. But, if we have hidden nodes, that's not so great. So one idea we might have is, if we actually want to, reduce collisions at the cost of a lot of bandwidth, we could set our slot time to, say, the maximum packet time. But that isn't worth it with this big variation in packet time. We're like going to, if our average packet size is like 5 microseconds, we're leaving the channel idle for at least half the time. If it's close to 10, then maybe that's a good idea. So I'd say, is there a better solution to this problem here when we have these collisions? So we can at least detect them kind of after the fact because of our ACK idea. We can limit the effect of the collisions by deliberately transmitting smaller amounts of data, so at least, we detect it faster, but at the cost of waiting between transmissions, which is going to not use the full bandwidth. So there's one strategy that might be better for this, and that's to observe that we want to coordinate things at the receiver. Was that a question? Okay. The big problem with both of these scenarios is that we're kind of looking at A and B's perspective when we really want to know about C and D's perspective. Right. That's what we're missing, is that we don't have information about what C and D are doing, kind of deciding when to transmit. So an idea that can arguably improve the hidden node problem, at least, is that we can kind of try to have C participate in sort of letting people know about this interference. So this will be a solution to the hidden node problem, and we'll think about like what can we do about the exposed node problem. But the hidden node problem is the much more common one, so it's what we're going to be concerned about. So one idea that sort of takes advantage of this idea that, oh, we should have the receiver help coordinate things is something called request to send, clear to send. So the problem we had with our hidden node problem is that we both decided to transmit without like actually asking C if there would be interference, but C could figure out actually in this case that there would be interference. So what we'll do is we'll have, you know, we want to send between two nodes, we'll make a request to send, and then our receiver will tell us it's okay to do so. And this request will be much, much shorter than a normal packet, and so it's much less likely to collide randomly, even if we have hidden nodes. Right. If we're sending very short things, it's not worth doing this. Because the request and the response waiting, that's going to take as long as transmitting what we were transmitting anyways. We might as well just transmit that at the beginning. But if we're sending something longer, then this is worth doing because we can avoid interference by having our receiver realize, oh, someone else should be sending to me now. Don't do it. Or if we interfere with someone sending to them, we won't get a response and we'll realize we better not keep going and they can retry earlier and so on. The other thing we can do is that when we hear a clear to send message, when C in this case tells B, hey, you wanted to send 1,000 bytes to me? Why don't you do that now? Well, A can hear that. And it doesn't have to just ignore it. It can receive that message and say, oh, that means that for the next 1,000 bytes of time, I better not transmit anything or I'm going to cause C interference. So what A can do is A can pretend that if they were doing carrier sense, that there's a carrier for the next 1,000 bytes, even if though they can't receive B. They know B is going to transmit, assuming things go well, for 1,000 bytes, they can just say, the channel's busy for the next 1,000 bytes of time, let's not transmit right now. And so this kind of avoids us from having the problem of, what if I request to send while you're already sending? Well, if we overhear the clear to sends, we won't do that. And so this kind of mitigates our hidden node problem. And we can also overhear in the other direction, right? If we overhear if we overhear B saying, hey, I'd like to send some bytes, A can realize, well, I shouldn't transmit right now because, you know, C is about to send a clear to send probably, and then we're going to send for a while. I should stay quiet to avoid interfering with that. So questions on request to send, clear to send? Okay. So let's talk about whether when RTS CTS helps. So what the effect would be like. So let's say we have two nodes transmitting to each other and there's no hidden nodes. What is RTS CTS going to do to our performance? So I have the scenario I have is I don't have A and B, A, B, and C. I just have A and B, and we're sending messages back and forth. Yeah?
You mean just an extra microsecond for the request to send
an extra second? Okay. So we're saying that we're going to have plus 1 microsecond for each transmission. Yeah, so it's actually going to slow us down when we have no hidden nodes. So this is a reason why Wi-Fi supports RTS CTS, and it's usually not enabled. And this is probably why, that it doesn't actually always improve performance. It only improves performance we actually have hidden nodes. When we do have hidden nodes, this should sort of reduce, the collisions by like a 100x or maybe a 50x-ish, 100x type factor. As under assumption that the collision probability is proportional to the message length, which might not really be true. And we'll go through here. So with that in mind, let's go check where we are. So when is RTS CTS a better idea? Than not doing RTS CTS. We'll just do a show of hands, give you a second to think over things, check with neighbors. Oh, I see what I did here. This is what happens when I sort options without changing letters. Okay, so let's do who thinks A is a scenario where, when more messages are sent by one node versus being split across all the nodes, who thinks that's a better for RTS CTS? Worse for RTS CTS? That would be what I agree with, because there's less probability of collisions. Right? And we're spending extra time to prevent collisions. If almost all of them are transmitted by one node, there's almost no collisions. How about if messages are shorter, who thinks RTS CTS is better, is worse? Yeah, because our overhead sort of gets higher for the same, for avoiding fewer, we avoid fewer collisions for the same overhead. And that is less likely to be worthwhile. How about our third option, more nodes can hear the others who are transmitting? Who thinks that's better for RTS CTS? I think that's worse. So we have a mix here. So what's the argument for it being better? Anyone want to do that? Better for RTS CTS if more nodes can hear each other. Sure. Yeah.
Maybe someone can solve the exposing node problem?
Maybe someone can solve the exposing node problem. So the exposed node problem was that we had two transmissions here. And there's a problem, RTS CTS as I've described it, deals very poorly with that, actually. And the reason it deals very poorly is because of our notion that when we overhear a request to send, we should pause.
Because L is assuming that, for example, if it's labeled, do you mind like giving a label for the notes?
Giving.
Like on your drawing on the exercise page?
Yeah. Which drawing?
On the exercise page, yeah. That drawing?
Yeah.
Do you mind labeling?
Sure. Yeah.
B will know that, okay, A
is
sending to C, so I can send to B.
So your notion is that, oh, if B hears a request to send from A and not a clear to send from C, B should know that it can transmit at the same time. So this is assuming, so I think there's two issues here. So one is that the protocol we told you says that, no, we reserve the channel for some time to do that. The other issue is that we're assuming that the transmission is symmetric, and that's not guaranteed. It's not guaranteed that just because B can't hear C, that C can't hear B. So B does have a way of detecting it's in the exposed node scenario, for as far as C is concerned. It could be the case that when C transmits, that its transmission is enough to interfere with A's, even though it can't receive intelligible stuff from C. Right. We can't reliably detect using RTS-CTS that we're in the whether or not we're in the exposed node scenario or just a normal interference scenario. And also, more importantly, even when we are in the exposed node scenario, this design where we, you know, hear a message, request to send, and don't transmit, like, is going to always do the conservative thing and not take advantage of the extra exposed node bandwidth. So I would say for the third scenario here that this is kind of mixed because. Because there's an argument that if even when everyone could hear each other, maybe request to send is going to allow us to avoid collisions by sort of pre-reserving the bandwidth. You know, we're going to avoid collisions we would otherwise have had because of that sort of strategy that when we hear a request to send, we don't transmit for a while. Versus if we just detransmitted long packets, they might interfere. We might not detect the collision until they're all done. So there's an argument that's kind of mixed, but like I think it's generally probably worse because, you know, the CTS part, right, the clear to send part, like that's really about dealing with hidden nodes. But the request to send, like arguably, it could, depending on how long our messages are versus the request to send, maybe it could help. It probably depends more on not whether there are more nodes that can hear each other, but whether, you know, we have a higher probability of collisions or not. You know, so it's worth spending more time to avoid collisions. And for D, I would say it probably is a better idea. Okay, so I guess I'm out of time, and I'm so sorry for fumbling Ethernet cable length stuff because I assumed I could wing something. I definitely couldn't. And I guess I know, there are other things going on there that I probably should talk about. I'll talk briefly about next time, though I shouldn't. There are ECE topics I've avoided going into and shouldn't go into because we aren't ECE students here. For some reason, it's not cross-listed with ECE. I don't know why. That are also affect the maximum cable length, other than propagation delay, which is why my math didn't work out. Part of why my math didn't work out. I realized, the propagation delay is important, but it's not the only thing that's going on there. And next time we'll talk about some more wireless interference issues. So like our preview is something that's annoying about wireless is that I told you, oh, it's just a nice little distance, but that's not really what goes on.